Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley, 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop Medical Monday for July 11th. I'm Alan Chartok. Underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from Protex Gloves, helping to provide relief from chronic skin and hand conditions, including peripheral neuropathy, scleroderma, Raynaud's and eczema, UVA and UVB sun protection, protexgloves.com. Joining us today is Dr. Matthew Staniszewski. Dr. Staniszewski is a rheumatologist with Dartmouth Hitchcock Putnam Physicians at Southwestern Vermont Medical Center in Bennington. He's here to answer your questions, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. If you've been trying to get in touch with a rheumatologist and haven't been able to, today is your day. Again, 1-800-348-2551. Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show, Medical Monday. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Dr. Matthew Staniszewski. He's a rheumatologist with Dartmouth Hitchcock Putnam Physicians at Southwest Vermont Medical Center in Bennington. He specializes in the diagnosis and treatment of rheumatoid conditions, including rheumatoid arthritis, gout, lupus, scleroderma, ABD, osteoporosis. Dr. Staniszewski earned his medical degree from the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine and most recently served as a fellow in rheumatology at Roger Williams Medical Center, Rhode Island Hospital, and the VA Medical Center in Providence. He also worked as a clinical trial investigator with the Center for Medical Research, also in Providence. He's a member of the American College of Physicians and American College of Osteopathic Internists. In addition, he's a member of the American College of Rheumatology and the New England Rheumatism Society. Got a question for Dr. Staniszewski? Give us a call at 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Well, Matt, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Is it fun to be a rheumatologist?
It's great.
Is that one of those good diseases, good specialties, or bad specialties? In other words, are outcomes always ending in bad things, or can you actually help people?
No, actually, we have a variety of treatments for a lot of our conditions, including, rheumatoid arthritis and other inflammatory conditions that I treat. And it's actually the field has evolved dramatically, even in the past 15, 20 years with actually really exciting and exciting therapies that have actually given a lot of people hope, for a lot of disorders that really we didn't have good treatments for before. So,
and what is rheumatoid arthritis?
So rheumatoid arthritis is can be thought of as a disorder that people develop that basically causes a lot of inflammation in the joints, and that's basically what happens in this disorder, where you develop an immunologic response. Your body's own immunologic response starts almost to basically attack the joints and causes a lot of swelling and pain and disability for people.
And if I say Mad King George, what do you say? Gout, you say?
Yeah, it's gout. It's always gout.
Okay. All right. We got, oh boy, the phones are literally all filled up already, which is amazing. So we'll go very quickly then to Jim in Matamoros. Thank you, Jim. What do you got?
What role does Streptococcus mutans play in rheumatic conditions?
So strep mutans has been proposed as one of the infectious agents that may set off the immunologic response in certain types of arthritic conditions and inflammatory disorders. It's really been shown in some studies to maybe create that initial spark of for the immune system for some of these inflammatory disorders to really take hold and come out in the human body.
Thank you very much, Jim. Okay, now we're going to go to Oliver in Rhinebeck. Oliver, you're on.
Hi, doctor. Thank you for being on the air today. I had a question about symptoms of gout and what types of foods potentially precipitate that. I eat a lot of chocolate, and I'm wondering if that's what created the pain I was having in my left toe.
So this is a great question for a lot of people. So gout is a disorder that causes inflammation in several different parts of the body, usually in the toe, and this is a very problematic condition for a lot of people. What it actually is it's caused by a crystal that forms in the joint. It's actually caused by high uric acid. And the high uric acid is formed due to these molecules called purines. And foods that are high in purines participate in elevating the uric acid level and contribute to a higher incidence of gout.
Is chocolate one of them?
And chocolate is actually interesting. This is kind of I don't want to call it taboo, but it's in my practice, I haven't seen a whole lot of people that have had problems with chocolate and causing their gout. However, there are certain people that have these types of reactions to certain foods which can precipitate their gout. All I can say is that the only way to know whether or not it's setting off your inflammation and your gout is to avoid it. Okay, and so if you avoid it the best you can, okay.
Thank you.
End up breaking it. You end up breaking your fast from this food, and all of a sudden you develop the inflammation right afterwards.
Don't do it.
Then that's your trigger.
Right.
And that's what we call a trigger. So.
But what about chocolate covered asparagus?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I think that's
asparagus is a well-known agent, right?
So things that are high in purines. Basically, are mm-hmm. your shellfish, your red meats, actually things that are high in fructose. Sugary syrups and things like that a lot of people don't really know about can kind of contribute to.
So it would be best not to eat it all, right?
Hey, thanks. Sounds like I have to give up my favorite things. Thank you so
thanks,
much.
Thanks, Oliver. Bye bye. Okay. Yeah. Okay, and we'll go to Patrick in Boston. Okay, Patrick, go.
All right, how you doing? I'm 48 years old, and I stopped getting the gout probably for the last 4 years because I'm on a urolytic medication. And I was from 17 all the way up to like 44 years old. I was getting gout attacks for between 15 to 25 times out the year. And I had them in all my joints, my hip, my fingers, my ankles, my Achilles heels, and my elbows. And I even had tophi coming out my ears, which was high uric acid, and my elbows. And I'd like to know, since the urolytic, I've been taking the urolytic, if I had stopped taking it, would I get the gout back? Would it come back?
So the Uloric, what the Uloric is doing is it's...
Now, that's the medicine.
Yeah,
right?
Uloric is Fuboxystat. That's a medication that actually decreases the uric acid in the body. And what happens is that is keeping the uric acid at a stable level, okay? And it's keeping it low and it's keeping it stable. What happens is if you were to stop that medication, potentially your uric acid level could rise in the body. And when the body doesn't like it when your uric acid fluctuates significantly like that, and if it were to go really high, then potentially you could develop a gout attack. So it's actually It's actually recommended that if you're started on a what we call urate lowering medication, which keeps the uric acid level very low, okay, to stay on it unless recommended otherwise by your doctor.
Now, what did he say was coming out of his ears? I didn't catch that.
He said something called tophi. So tophi,
which is not foo, it's phi.
So tophi are basically where the uric acid crystallizes, and it can cause these lesions that have a particular appearance on the skin.
Oh.
And it's
okay. Thank you, Patrick. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, now we're going to go. No, now we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Albany Cardiothoracic Surgeons, providing patient-centered heart surgery for over 40 years in the Capital Region. Practicing cardiac surgery at St. Peter's Hospital, ACTSURG.com. NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses, NBTBank.com. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, Thai, and entrees. Offering daily specials, 518-432-0358. Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center, offering a Master of Social Work degree, full-time, part-time, day, evening, weekend options, online, in-person, hybrid courses, adelphi.edu for more information. And from Tom McRae, Edward Jones Financial Advisor, on University Drive, Amherst, Massachusetts, member SIPC, Edward Jones, making sense of investing, edwardjones.com/Tom McRae.
So we're here with Dr. Matthew Staniszewski. He's a rheumatologist with Dartmouth-Hitchcock Putnam Physicians at Southwest Vermont Medical Center in Bennington. That may be the longest name in all of organized medicine. I'm not quite sure. But anyway, it's a great place, and we very much appreciate you guys coming all the way down here to do that today. Okay, so we're going back to the phones now. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Paul in Westfield. Paul, you're on.
Hi, doctor. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A couple of months ago, I started getting tingling and numbness in my fingertips, and the fingertips were red. So I went to see my PCP, and he ran kidney function, thyroid, diabetes. Those all came back normal, so he sent me off to a hand specialist last week who preliminarily diagnosed me with cubital tunnel syndrome. I get the fuzzy elbows and the funny bones thing from time to time into the two smaller fingers. So I'm having a nerve conduction test done next week. But one of the things that neither of these doctors have been able to help me with is, along with all these other things, the palms of my hands get really red. If I raise them above my head or put them under cold water or in an air condition, they go back to normal. So, I do have rheumatoid arthritis that runs in my family. My mom had it, and my brother has it now. I'm just wondering what else I should be looking for that these folks can't seem to explain the red palms.
I understand.
Let's let the doctor answer. And by the way, if you're listening on the radio, you're breaking a big rule. Turn off the radio. Okay, and listen in the phone. Go ahead, Matt. I'm sorry.
So rheumatoid arthritis is a disorder that causes swelling and inflammation in the hands. And one of the biggest places for it to affect are the big knuckles on the hands that are closest to the palm, as well as the wrists, okay? And it causes a lot of pain and swelling in these areas, okay? And if you don't have pain particularly, or swelling or stiffness in these areas, then I would think of something else other than rheumatoid arthritis that would cause it. But you know, there are other things that can cause palm, particular hand redness, and disorders other than rheumatoid arthritis that I would probably think that would be more likely than that. If the only time that you get it is when you're raising your hands over your head or you know after you get out of the shower, there are. There is something called erythromyalgia, which does cause some redness of the palms. There are some other different types of disorders that can cause this as well. But does it look like a rash that you're having?
No, not at all.
Okay.
In fact, when I put my hands above my head, the redness goes away.
Oh, it goes away. The fact that your hands are above your heart is it because the blood is literally kind of coming out of your hands and all of a sudden there was the palmar redness kind of goes away. It's tough to tell what's causing that. If there's not a rash, okay, and there's not a and there's no swelling in the joints, I would probably think of something other than a rheumatic disease, and I would think of something other than rheumatoid arthritis certainly.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right, and now we are going to go to Ruth in Schoharie. Ruth, you're on. Your turn.
Hi. My son, he's 33. He's been working in a restaurant for over 10 years, and his constant going to from freezer, refrigerator, cold foods to hot ovens seems to have caused his hands to go white in just cool temperatures. If it's 50 degrees out, his hands are white. Is that what they call Raynaud or something like that disease?
Yes, actually, there's a disorder that's called Raynaud's disease. This is a circulatory problem that's very common in the normal population, and it also can happen alongside of some rheumatologic conditions, but it's much more common when it just happens on its own. And what this is a cold induced spasm of the blood vessels in the fingers, which causes your fingers to go white and then maybe turn blue and then turn very red when the blood starts to come back into them. And sometimes this can be very painful for people. It can cause numbness and can cause tingling. It can cause pain. And the best way to treat this is to prevent it from happening in the first place. So patients with Raynaud's or Raynaud's disease should make sure that they wear gloves and thick wool socks to cover their extremities, and to really make sure that their core organs are warm. So bundling up with a vest or extra layers in the core area to keep their core organs warm. If your heart and your lungs and your core organs are kept warm, you're less likely to clamp off your circulation in your fingers when you're exposed to the cold. So,
is there a genetic component to this, Doc?
So this oftentimes I see it can be associated and run kind of in families. However, a lot of times it can happen in anyone, and you really don't know who it's going to happen to. But it can. I have seen it run in families.
Okay, Ruth, thank you very much. All right, and now we're on with Nicole in Nassau. Okay, Nicole, you're on.
Hi.
Hey.
I've been diagnosed with Sjogren's.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have some osteoporosis, but so far, according to what the symptoms of Sjogren's are, I just have dry eyes and some fatigue occasionally. Is there anything I could be doing, or is there a medication? I mean, apparently it can get progressively worse.
So Sjogren's syndrome is a disorder that causes dry eyes and dry mouth. It's also called the Sicca syndrome. It is a caused by its basis is that it is an autoimmune condition, and one of the more common autoimmune conditions, where the body produces antibodies and causes inflammation and in the glands that produce saliva and they produce tears, okay? And what happens is these glands start to become inflamed and they stop producing the lubrication that you need for your oral cavity and for your eyes, okay? So if you have dry eyes, and that is basically your biggest complaint, then the best thing you can do is to try to lubricate them as much as you need. Okay, so artificial tears, or you know, over the counter, you can get over the counter artificial tears. Okay, I would stay away from products with any alcohol in them. So things like Visine and Clear Eyes, they're great at getting the red out, but they're not great for keeping the eyes lubricated. So,
how about Restasis?
Restasis is a great option for people who can't get their dry eyes under control from more conservative measures like the artificial tears. Okay.
Hey, Nicole, thank you for calling. Appreciate it.
Okay,
and now we are going to go to Prudence, who's been very patient and hanging on for quite a while. But before we do, I just want to give the number 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. There are two people, there'll be three, actually, with Prudence, and then you'll be right on. So get going. All right, Prudence, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I had my older sister died over a year and a half ago, and as a result of autoimmune diseases, and she had markers for scleroderma, lupus, and then one I can't pronounce, but it's dermatomyositis or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it first was obvious that her fingers all swelled up really huge. And then it really progressed quickly, and I don't know how long she'd actually had any of this stuff because she never went to the doctor. But my question to you is there a genetic or a hereditary component to any of these autoimmune diseases? I never got an answer from any doctors.
So for a lot of these disorders that we have that I treat, there is a lot of genetic basis for that. There is, and a lot of it has to do with something called the HLA gene components, and there's a lot of research going into this field right now to try to figure out what is that exact gene, or you know, what is that exact gene that is making us that creates all this inflammation and all these issues for patients with rheumatic disease. And to put this on an elementary level, the way to think about it is that patients with these disorders tend to be genetically predisposed to develop them. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's something sets off this immune response in the body, some sort of virus or something out in the community that we're exposed to that sets off an immunologic response and turns these genes on and causes and starts the inflammation process that leads to these disorders, and there's still a lot of genetic research that's going on in this field.
Is there anything anybody could do because they are related, they have a sister or something? Mm-hmm. Is there anything you could do to sort of prevent it from getting to you?
Not really. There's no way to know who is going to develop this. Beforehand, one of the hardest things about our rheumatic diseases, things like lupus and scleroderma, is that people that have the markers in the blood for these disorders, there are certain markers in the blood that we can test that may point us in a direction that if you're having certain symptoms and you have a certain antibody, that you may have this disorder. But there are a lot of people in the community that have these antibodies floating around in their blood, and it will never cause an issue for them. Mm-hmm. So there's no real way to know if one person is going to develop this disorder or when it's going to happen. But you can say that, you know, could it be possible that this disorder could show up at some point in the future? Yes, it could, but there's no way to know.
So looking into the future, Doc, and, you know, the possibilities of cures, what would you think is coming?
So actually there have been, at least in the last 10 years, maybe 15 years, the explosion of research into these areas has been quite remarkable, and I think that within the next 10 or 20 years we will be looking at these disorders in a different light, and we will be able to more accurately predict who is going to develop a particular rheumatic disorder, and we will be able to better start them on treatment earlier.
Okay, thanks for the call. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. I'm looking at our new fancy system to make sure I know who's coming next. Yes, it's Dean. Dean, you are going to be the winner if I can find the one that has you on it. I can't see it now. Dean is on, Springfield. Dean, oh, there she is, or he is. Okay, Dean, you're on. Hi, Dean.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Okay, go.
So I have type 3 acromion in my right shoulder as well as a torn labrum. I have friends telling me this is going to develop into nasty arthritis and fix it now. I have other friends saying hold off as long as you possibly can and have the surgery later on. What's your thoughts? And thank you very much.
Okay, are you calling from the middle of the Holland Tunnel?
I've got you on Bluetooth, unfortunately, because I'm driving.
Okay, that's the way to go. We'd rather see that than the obvious. Matt, you want an answer?
Sure. So what you're talking about here is damage. Is really damage to the tendons and in the area of the shoulder and the tissues that really are holding the shoulder together. Okay, what happens when you have an injury there is that you basically develop inflammation in the area, and you develop an instability in the area. And when the joints are unstable, there are stressors that are put over the joint that normally aren't put there, so that the integrity of the joint is not as strong, okay? And over time, if the integrity of the joint is not as strong, it can lead to arthritis, okay? And we do see that patients that have had different types of injuries to the area and that have had issues with strength in the area, that they can develop arthritis in those joints earlier, okay? But this is a decision that you should really have with your physician that's treating you as far as the best way to go as far as surgery, okay?
What would they do with surgery, Matt?
As a rheumatologist, I really don't do surgery.
Yeah, but okay? What would a surgeon do?
So a surgeon would consider the options for basically either repairing the tendon or repairing the shoulder in several different ways that they could. Okay, there are multiple ways to approach that. However, to give the options, there's the only way to know which way would be best for you would be to discuss it with your surgeon.
Okay. Thank you very much.
It said, wait as long as I can. I've seen two different doctors. One was more aggressive. One said, wait as long as you can, and when we go in there, we'll clean up the damage. And then they, something to the extent of make space, which would help prevent the arthritis from forming in the future.
Right. So what...
I've heard two different things, and
okay.
I'd rather wait, but I also don't want to have a problem later on either.
Right. So there's two ways to look at that, and that's... And that's do you wait as long as you can because you could end up having issues with the joint later on several years from now due to the surgery, or do you get it repaired now and strengthen the joint so that you don't develop arthritis? And the way to think about that is that if you're motivated. And you're motivated to help rehab the joint, then you could consider the surgical option earlier. However, again, this is something for you to have a discussion with your surgeon about.
Thank you very much. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Ellis Hospital Emergency Department, providing access to emergency care for everything from fever, cough, and flu to sprains, cuts, and chest pain. Day or night, better care starts now. EllisMedicine.org. The Brattleboro Retreat's Emerging Adult Program, providing specialized inpatient mental health and addiction care for people ages 18 to 26. BrattleboroRetreat.org. Preservation League of New York State, offering EPIP, a revolving loan program to acquire, stabilize, and restore historic buildings in New York so our past has a future. Maybe Farm Historic Site, Rotterdam Junction, New York, presenting Canal Fest, Explore Schenectady County, featuring music, bicycle tours, crafts, games, ice cream for kids, and more. July 16th, 10 to 3, SchenectadyHistorical.org. And from Amherst Copy and Design Works, offering printing and copying, sign making, and design services from booklets to stationery and labels to lawn signs in downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, AmherstCopy.com.
And we are back with Dr. Matthew Staniszewski. He's a rheumatologist with Dartmouth Hitchcock Putnam Physicians at Southwest Vermont Medical Center in Bennington. Thank you all for joining us. The lines are jammed. I just want to tell everybody, so be as brief as you can to give the next person a chance. We'll go now to Barbara, and I'm going to find her there. Okay, there you are. Barbara, you're on.
Yes. I have a general question. How many of these immune disorders are connected to Lyme disease and its co-infections?
So... This is an issue that comes a lot comes up a lot in our rheumatology clinic. The immune response that patients get from Lyme disease it can be very debilitating sometimes. And usually when a Lyme disease occurs and it goes untreated for a period of time, what can happen is you can, in a rare amount of cases, it can involve the joint, and it's because the actual joint becomes infected from the bacteria that cause Lyme disease, and that sets off an immunologic response in the joint, and it can cause a lot of inflammation and problems for patients, even on a more chronic basis. But to get back to your question, I think there's going to be more research coming out on this topic of after patients being affected from Lyme disease, does this set off an immune response? Could this be one of those infections or things in the community that patients are exposed to that can set off their type of immunologic disorder or rheumatic disorder if they're genetically predisposed to develop one. And I think that's something that's going to be increasingly focused on in the future. I don't think that I'm equipped to answer that question at this point, but hopefully we will know more in the future.
Thank you very much. Okay. And now that leaves us with Robert in North Adams. Okay, Robert, you're on. Robert.
Hello. Quick question. I have a sister who had pain in one of her fingers in the joints and pretty much self-diagnosed herself as having gout. And her online research convinced her that it was due to eating, I guess, vegetables mostly that are in the nightshade family. And so she's avoiding, I believe, things like tomatoes, and I'm not sure what else is in this family, but claims the pain has gone away. And I was just wondering what your doctor had to say about nightshade and gout.
So,
what we call the deadly nightshade family.
Yes.
So the deadly
nightshade family, not the friendly one. Yeah.
So there has been there have been a lot of so-called anti-inflammatory diets, and certain foods that we eat, do they have these nightshade and pro-inflammatory products in them that really can lead to inflammation? And from what I can see, I have not really seen any convincing research that's the case necessarily with gout. Okay, there is hopefully some promising work that will come out in the future about different types of diets and the anti-inflammatory properties that they might contribute to, or pro-inflammatory or anti-inflammatory properties that they might have. I think, in my experience, reading these studies, is that for every one study that might show an association one way, there's another study that proves the opposite. So it's when you're looking at these studies on anti-inflammatory and pro-inflammatory diets as a whole, it's really difficult to say one way or the other. But as far as gout, I haven't really seen that.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's go to Daniel in Tilson. Okay, Daniel, you're on.
Hi. I had psoriasis since I was about 13, had it about 40 years, and in my early 50s, I developed psoriatic arthritis, which I understand is kind of a type of rheumatoid arthritis. And, if you agree, I just wanted to alert listeners, because I was not alerted to it, that then increases your risk for heart attack. I did have a heart attack. I'm okay. And I guess what I wanted to ask you is, are there blood tests that I should be monitoring to really watch the inflammation?
I think that this is a topic that's actually really been touched on really over the last 5 to 10 years, and that's the fact that rheumatic disorders, including rheumatoid arthritis and psoriatic arthritis, they're associated with a lot of inflammation, and these disorders when your body's exposed to a lot of inflammation, there's a higher incidence of heart disease and cardiovascular disease, and the research that's coming out now is really telling us that is fact, and it should be addressed and it should be treated. And patients who have rheumatoid arthritis and psoriatic arthritis who have cardiovascular risk factors should be monitored closer, and the risk factors should be treated. Okay.
Is there a risk in exercise?
So actually, exercise is, it's not really a risk in exercise. The risk factors for heart disease, you know, whether or not your family, you have a family history of heart disease. Did your mother or father have an early heart attack? Do you have high cholesterol? Okay, do you have hypertension? Do you have diabetes? And if these are all the case, then they should be treated as best they can and controlled as best they can before you develop the heart attack in the first place.
Sure. Okay? Statins and things like that.
Right. So I think that exactly. So if it's a statin that's needed to control your high cholesterol, that is becoming more of a focus even for rheumatologists to make sure that your cardiovascular risk factors are well controlled. Especially when you're dealing with a rheumatic disease that causes a lot of inflammation in the body. And to get to your point, as far as is there a certain blood test that can be really be monitored for this, there really isn't. The best thing we can do is really make sure that if your cholesterol is high, that it's treated. If your blood pressure is high, then it's treated. If your blood sugar is high, and you have diabetes, it needs to be treated. And
do you do all of that, or do you send them to other people to do that?
For the most part, these disorders are treated by a primary care physician, but we will actively look for these risk factors and get them to the right place if we need to.
Right.
And if we need to, we will treat them.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's go to Michael in Cummington. Okay, Michael, you're on.
About 10 years ago, I was diagnosed with RA, and about a month ago, my primary care physician said, sometimes the rheumatoid arthritis burns itself out. And I looked at her and go, what? Are you serious? She goes, you should talk to your rheumatologist about that. So that was, have you ever heard of anything like that? And another part of this question is, I've also heard that avocado seeds ground up and put in your smoothies, vegetable smoothies in the morning, is also a natural anti-inflammatory. Is that true or false? So that's my question.
Okay, so to answer the question about the burnt-out RA, so burnt-out rheumatoid arthritis. There is a point where rheumatoid arthritis can kind of metaphorically run its course, and for a lot of people that had caused a lot of inflammation and pain at one point in the past, it finally stops causing a lot of pain. Okay, however, we have to be very cognizant that even though you might not be having swelling and pain in these disorders, there still can be inflammation going on underneath that. And I think that that's important to know, okay? So while you can have rheumatoid arthritis and your pain and swelling might not be as great, okay? It may be characterized as kind of a burnt out, okay, where it kind of flames out. We call it sometimes a flaming out because it causes hot warmth in the joints, and all of a sudden it goes cold, and that's what that really means. But there still can be inflammation going on underneath there, and if there's inflammation going on underneath there, it can lead to joint damage, and that's what we don't want. So I think that that's really should be followed by the rheumatologist for the rheumatoid arthritis pretty closely, regardless, and obviously listen to your rheumatologist for treatment.
Thank you very much. That was a good question. Let's go to Sue in Williamstown. Sue in Williamstown, you're on.
Yes, I'd like to know whether osteoporosis is a rheumatology disease or an endocrinology disease. And is there a genetic component to this? I had read somewhere suggesting that there might be.
Well, the first question is great, actually, and the answer is both. Both rheumatologists and endocrinologists treat osteoporosis, and it does depend on really the your your referring physician. We both are trained in, endocrinologists and rheumatologists are both trained in osteoporosis treatment and management. So either one should be able to treat the osteoporosis. Second off, is osteoporosis a genetic, does it have a genetic component to it? And I think that the
research... Did you say it does?
I'm addressing that question right now. I think it can have a genetic basis in the appropriate patient. Osteoporosis is a disorder that can happen for multiple reasons. Okay, and there are certain medications that can put you at risk for developing osteoporosis in the future if you've been exposed to steroids. Even other types of drugs that can potentially lead to osteoporosis, and there are also there have been some studies that have shown that there can be a genetic component to it as well. So,
okay, I got to let you go because there's a lot of people behind you. Thank you very much. Sue. Very quickly, there was a new class of drugs for osteoporosis. I was just reading something about it, a lot of people didn't want to take it. In the beginning, they had a black box around them, which is a warning from the feds that you better watch out. Now it's had more acceptance, but people aren't using it.
So, it's therapies for osteoporosis. There are some medications that we use to treat osteoporosis classically. Is a class of medications called bisphosphonates.
Sure.
And there's a very low risk. There's a very low risk where they did the studies for these medications, and they noticed a slightly higher incidence in bone necrosis involving the jaw. Okay.
Right.
So became this kind of taboo against these medications for developing this, when it actually, in all reality, the risk of developing this jaw necrosis is actually pretty low, and these medications are generally well tolerated.
Uh-huh.
And one of the newer medications out is called Prolia for osteoporosis. Now, this is a medication that's only appropriate in certain patients. However, it is a medication that also has this disorder, the risk of this potential risk of osteonecrosis of the jaw, but it works in a different fashion than your classic bisphosphonates, okay? And it can be a great option for patients that have been intolerant of the bisphosphonates.
So we're really running out of time now. We'll go to did I hang up that one? What didn't I hang up that one? I don't know. Yeah, I think I hung up. So now we'll go to Brian in Shelburne Falls. Brian.
Thank you, Alan. You're a gift to our community, and Doc, thanks for all the info. Could you speak to the general theme here is inflammation. Could you speak to the psychological state of stress, distress, and anxiety and how it produces inflammatory hormones within us, and the opposite, how gratitude and being grateful throughout our day and compassionate to all beings and how that stimulates the production of anti-inflammatories in our body, and how that affects all that we've been talking about.
Okay,
today.
Great question.
Thank you, Alan.
Great question. Go.
So this is a great question. I've seen and I've treated a lot of rheumatic disorders, and it seems that these disorders do get worse. A lot of them will get worse and so-called flare in times of stress. And they will be dormant or get better or remit in cases where you're under less stress, and I think that's an important phenomenon as far as the actual biologic basis behind that. There is a lot of research that's going on about that right now, and hopefully we'll know more.
Thank you very much. Okay, we haven't had a lupus question, so I'll get us a lupus question really quickly.
Okay.
Okay, go. You only got a minute.
Okay, my question is, my husband was diagnosed with Crohn's about 10 years ago, And he went into remission since, but in the last year, he has gotten that classic butterfly rash on his face.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if one inflammatory disease, such as Crohn's, can trigger another inflammatory disease, or if it's just all part of that original disease.
So so some of the disorders like lupus and Crohn's disease, I mean, you're kind of comparing apples and oranges. They're different types. They're different disorders that have different that are biologically different. However, these there are certain inflammatory disorders like thyroid disease, like lupus, and other similar inflammatory disorders that can coexist in the same person. Okay, so and I do see that very commonly.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm sorry we are out of time. We are out of time, and I'm going to thank David and whoever's calling from a payphone, and Rod and Matthew and Patricia and Estelle and Lisa. They're all hanging on the phone, but not today. So anyway, we are out of time. And I want to thank everyone who did call in. Apologize to those left on the line. I'd also like to thank Dr. Matthew Staszewski for joining us today. Underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from Nathan Littauer Hospital, Gloversville, New York, proudly introducing the gastroenterologist specialist of Littauer, working to provide patients with comfort during colonoscopy procedures, NLH.org. Thanks, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz, who really does understand the system a lot better than I do. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.